Hi, everybody. So we're going to get started now. Just a little reminder that we're recording this webinar today to be posted in future on the OTRU and PTCC websites. So you can revisit it should you desire or share it with your colleagues. And so we're here with a webinar co-presented by the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and PTCC on the impact of self-perceived health and professional advice on smoking behavior with Dr. Michael Chaitin and Dr. Bo Zhang, both from OTRU. And a little bit of housekeeping before, and my name's Sarah Pinder, and I'm here with PTCC. That's the last piece of information about our speakers today. A little bit of housekeeping before we get started. The lines are going to be muted during this call, so you can't speak over the phone to us, but you can ask your questions or comment on the presentation using the chat box on the right side of your screen. You should see some text already in there from one of our facilitators here, Debbie. And we're going to get started now, first with Michael's presentation. I'll also mention briefly that Dr. Chaitin will present, and then we're going to do a short Q&A, and then follow that up with Dr. Zhang's presentation and a Q&A to follow after that, so people know how today is going to be structured. And I'll introduce Dr. Chaitin now. So Michael Chaitin is an assistant professor at OTRU in the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto, and he's co-head of the Population Research Initiative on Mental Health and Addictions at OTRU. His work is focused on the social and psychosocial factors influencing tobacco use from a population health perspective. At OTRU, he's the project lead for the Ontario Tobacco Survey and holds a Career Development Award in Prevention from the Canadian Cancer Society. I'll also introduce Dr. Zhang now before Dr. Chaitin gets started. And Dr. Zhang, Bo Zhang is a senior research officer with OTRU. Bo received her master's degree in public health from Adelaide University, Australia, and a PhD in epidemiology from Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Her research interests include the epidemiology of tobacco use, the impact of tobacco policy on health, the role of tobacco in mortality and morbidity, and nicotine replacement therapy and health professional advice for smoking cessation in the general population. So I will let Michael get started.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here this morning. Just to up front say this study was undertaken at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, which receives funding from the Ontario Ministry of Health, and it was also partly funded by my Career Development Award from the Canadian Cancer Society. So smoking and smoking cessation is a journey. We know most people start smoking in adolescence, and they actually start trying to quit smoking within a few months after taking that first puff. We know, too, that people try and quit very frequently, on average about once per year. And if they're lucky, they're usually able to quit sometime in their mid-40s. And many people can take 10, 20, 30, 40, or hundreds of times to successfully quit. It's really difficult process, and it's something that's very challenging for most people. But despite this challenge, very few people use help and quit. In fact, about half of smokers on any given quit attempt use no help. There are a number of reasons for this, but one particular aspect is that many health professionals are actually hesitant to treat smoking as part of their daily practice. And there are all sorts of reasons for this as well, why health professionals may be reluctant to treat. There are issues in terms of time. It's lots of things to do. There are issues in terms of funding, if smoking cessation is unfunded, needing more resources, needing more training. There's a huge list of reasons here. But we're going to focus on a couple today. The first barrier is the poor success rate of smoking cessation. That is, that even a successful program, a very successful program in a general population or a clinical population, will see 9 of 10 people fail to quit. That is, that most people, you would expect, if they try and quit, are not going to succeed. And from both the perspective of the person trying to quit and from the healthcare professional, that's really disheartening and really discouraging when you try to do something and all you see is apparently failure. But those are actually or can be successful programs when you step back and look at the overall rates. Bo Jang will talk a little bit about effectiveness of health professional advice a little bit later and some of the factors associated with effectiveness. For my presentation, I'll be talking about a second barrier, that is, which particular moment to intervene. Particularly for professionals who are in a long-term relationship with clients like dentists or family physicians or social workers who see the same person on a regular basis, smoking and smoking cessation is not an acute event, generally. It's not. There's no driving moment which requires someone to quit smoking at this particular time in most circumstances. And most physicians and most other health professionals don't also want to come across as a nag or constantly reminding people to quit smoking, especially given the lack of effectiveness of any particular intervention. So for both the professional and for the smoker, it's important to find a moment in which there is more an evocative reason to quit, that is, that a burning platform in which the moment of smoking cessation becomes acute and that there is a reason both for the professional to give the advice and for the smoker to both hear, understand, and want to take it seriously. So one particular burning platform may be have to do with health and particularly changes in health. We know that health is the number one reason by a long shot of why people make a quit attempt. We also know that it's the number one reason why people who maintain a quit attempt say they stayed quit for health concerns. We also know numerous theories of health behavior change focus on this idea of health changes and health status as a key driver for motivating change and for actual changes in lifestyle. And particularly smoking cessation. But it's not just about health status or any particular disease diagnosis. In fact, we know that often people will quit when they're before the actual diagnosis. We know this from lung cancer, where we see people quitting about a couple of years before they actually get diagnosed. And we think that is to do with the physical and the perceived changes in health before they're actually sick enough to be diagnosed professionally. So we look then to sort of more qualitative measure of health, and in particular to perceived health. Perceived health is a very important and easy to measure concept of health. It's used in most national surveys, and it measures health on a simple 5-point scale. So from an epidemiological perspective, it's really useful. But it also corresponds to that very basic question of how are you doing and how are you feeling? And in surveys, we measure this from excellent to poor, but it corresponds to that very conversational question about how someone is feeling on a self-reported scale. Perceived health, though, despite the apparent vagueness of this question, is a very strong predictor of a number of health-related outcomes. It's a strong predictor of both morbidity and mortality, and we've seen this in numerous studies. There have been a number of papers that have looked at an existing relationship between perceived health and smoking behavior. That's not particularly surprising, given that smoking is bad for your health. And so it is not surprising that we see smokers tend to report more poor health than non-smokers. But there's actually surprisingly no information on perceived health on its own. There was one study that looked at perceived risk, which is a related topic. and quitting in a longitudinal survey. So we don't know, in fact, whether or not it is a predictor of being able to quit, making a quit attempt. So our question here then is perceived health associated with quitting behaviors on an Ontario population? And that does a change in perceived health predict changes in quitting behavior? That is health status important in understanding what people are going to do? And does a change in that status predict new changes in the way that they smoke? To study this question, we use the Ontario Tobacco Survey. This survey, designed by the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, was designed in order to study smoking cessation and the dynamics of smoking cessation in particular. It looked at smokers followed every 6 months for up to 3 years. This particular analysis we'll describe today uses a subsample of around 3,600 people who were current smokers at the beginning of the study and had some longitudinal data. We also examined males and females separately because there are some theoretical reasons to believe that this effect may have had different effects within each of these subpopulations. What we found in this Ontario survey was that there were a number of predictors of being in poor health, ones that weren't particularly surprising. For instance, being older, widowed or separated, or having less than high school education were all associated with having poor health. We also saw it was associated with a number of smoking history characteristics, such as having used pharmacotherapy previously, having received advice from a health professional, having more lifetime quit attempts, lower confidence in being able to quit, and higher perceived and addiction, as well as level of consumption of cigarettes. Again, these suggest that being in poor health, even among smokers, that those who are in lesser health tend to be those who are heavier smokers who have more difficulty quitting. We then looked at whether or not this poor health status was predictive of changes in smoking behavior in the future. That is, so we looked at the self-rated health at baseline and whether or not that predicted the onset of a quit attempt. And this is I'm just showing you the data here for females only. It's similar in men. What's happening here is that, in fact, there really wasn't a relationship between making a quit attempt and baseline self-rated health. If you squint a bit, you can sort of see a trend towards those with poor health maybe making more of a quit attempt, but really there was nothing statistically significant there. And certainly among the men, there's not even that ghost of a trend. If we look then at whether or not, if they made a quit attempt, whether or not having your status at baseline is more or less likely to relapse, that is to go back to smoking after having started a quit attempt, we see that unadjusted, that those who have lower perceived health were more likely to relapse than those in good health. So that the worse your health was, the more likely that you were to not succeed. However, even this relationship went away after we adjusted it for other smoking characteristics and demographic characteristics. That is that, yes, being in poor health is an indicator that you are less likely to succeed in a smoking attempt. But that's really explained by your other smoking characteristics, the likelihood that you are a heavier smoker or that you have some other or more addicted in other ways. So from these two sets of analyses right now, their story is not that promising for self-perceived health, but it's showing that there really isn't much of a relationship here between quitting behavior and health status, and that there really isn't an independent relationship of poor health and likelihood of success. However, what we really are interested in is what happens when you have a change in health, when somebody, when at the moment in which your health goes down or changes in some way. And this is also a slightly complicated slide, so we'll go through it. But this is looking at change in health. So, So we looked at three different outcomes here. We looked at cigarettes per day, changes in cigarettes per day, changes in intention to quit, and changes in the probability of making a quit attempt. And it's divided here by males and females, but you can, we can just look at males. And we have two indicators of changes in health. So this current health is really about concurrent changes in health. So whether or not a change in health from 6 months prior to now was, whether that change happened concurrently with the changes in our outcomes, such as cigarettes per day. Previous health is whether or not there was a change in the lagged health, so a change in your health status from 1 year ago to 6 months ago, whether or not that predicts a change in cigarettes per day from 6 months to the present. So this first line is whether or not change happens, of health happens concurrently, and the second one is whether or not a lag, whether a previous change in health has an impact. And what we see here, in fact, is that we use a statistical analysis called fixed effects regression. And this is important because we know there's all sorts of other things going on in smokers who have worse health. But using this type of regression, we can control for all of the factors that are internal to a person that don't change over time. So, for instance, all their genetics and other sort of smoking history characteristics that would have been constant over this period are entirely controlled for in a way that we can't do under any other different design. And when we look at it, when we do this regression, what we find is that, in fact, changes in health status are highly predictive of a lower number of cigarettes per day. They're also highly predictive of a change in the probability of making a quit attempt. A concurrent change is predictive of changing intention, a change in intention to quit. However, the lagged health change was not. We can see also that there is the lagged health is actually slightly more predictive of increase in quit attempt. So the story that we can take from this graph, this series of numbers, is that what happens at the as health changes, that moment also changes intentions to quit, and that change in intention to quit then drives future quit attempts. However, it is likely that this moment is not ends, and that change in intention to quit has a limited period of time which is effective at causing health behavior change, and is consequently potentially an important moment for this burning platform that we talked about earlier. So, in summary, a change in health status and a change in perceived health status is associated with changes in smoking behavior. We know that those with lower health are likely to be heavier smokers, have more difficulty quitting, but we also know that that having that change in health may be an opportunity for health behavior change, an opportunity to make a quit attempt. However, this time window for that opportunity may be limited, and so it's important to take advantage of this moment from a health professional perspective. And it's important to realize that those with lower levels of health are going to have more difficulty in quitting because of the likely other likely comorbidities associated with this group, and may need more resources in order to quit successfully. So that as a burning platform, it's important to it may be a moment where where more time spent on the intervention, more resources on the intervention are warranted in this particular group. So that is my part of the presentation today. So if you have any questions or questions of explanation, I'd be happy to take them now.
Thanks so much, Michael. We'll give people a minute to ask some questions. And you can, again, to remind folks, you can type your questions into the chat box so that we can read them out for everybody.
And I will be we'll be here. We can do questions as well.
Yeah, we can do.
At the end.
Oh, great. So there are some people typing typing now. We'll give them a moment to get their words on the screen. Okay, perfect. So Jeff Connors asks, does health change getting worse or getting better make a difference in change?
We also looked at, in a different analysis, we looked at just the effect of getting worse. And so this relationship, the way it presented, those numbers actually could have been either way, that getting better could have technically, so if people got better, it means that they started smoking more cigarettes. But in fact, it was that what we saw is that people who went from a good health status to a fair poor, when we divide that group that way, those people, it is that direction. So it is about getting worse, making that produces the change in smoking behavior. Getting better doesn't seem to have an effect on its own, which is good because it would have implied that getting better means you're less likely to make a quit attempt and less likely to smoke more, which, you know, there may be something to that. For people who don't have a health event.
And Judy Corcoran, you've taken my question, which was, have you identified what the time window is?
So we have a very rough sense of what this time is, because we only ask people about their status every 6 months. And so what we can say is that within a 6 month window, we don't know when that happened. We don't know exactly when the health behavior change happened within that window. We said, and it may be a little bit longer than either. We do know that when we extended that to a year, that was too long. So it's within the 6 months, I'd say, would be as detailed as we can say.
Fair enough. And it looks like there are some other people typing in the chat box. We'll wait for their questions. Anik T. LaBelle asks, how do you get the information on perceived health to the health professional?
Well, I mean, a health professional is a pretty good judge of health. There are two aspects here. One thing I didn't talk about was the actual diagnosis. And having a diagnosis, and particularly something that is smoking related, is another opportunity for health behavior intervention, one that is actually a little bit more studied. And it makes sense if you diagnose someone with lung cancer, that is an opportunity to talk about smoking cessation. Perceived health, though, we've looked at a formal question that is used in surveys, but it also does correspond with the conversational question of how you're feeling. It can be very easily ascertained in a general way. It is that moment of, where are people not feeling as well as they used to be? Okay.
I think we're going to move on to, thanks, Michael. I think we're going to move on to Bo Zhang's presentation next. So, Bo, there's you.
Okay, thanks, Sarah, and good morning, everyone. Now I'm going to talk about brief advice and smoking cessation in general population of Ontario smokers. We know from clinical evidence that advice from health professionals on cessation will increase the quit rate in the clinical patients. And they, even a brief advice can increase quitting rate by 60 or 70%. The relative risk is around 1.7. And intensive advice is even better, can increase the likelihood of quitting among clinical patients about 84%. However, population studies are very limited on this field. Currently, only a few population studies have been conducted, and the results are inconsistent. Most population-based studies have shown that brief advice increases quitting attempts, but is not associated with cessation. Other a few, maybe two or three population-based studies showing that brief advice is associated with cessation, but very limited. So we know that smoking cessation medications can increase quit rates, and health professionals can directly contribute to smokers' interest in using these cessation medications. But what we don't know is that in the general population, there hasn't been any study to examine the role of cessation medication as a mediating variable between advice from health professionals and subsequent quitting behavior. So the objective of this study is to examine whether cessation medication mediates the association between health professional advice and quitting in the general population. Michael has talked about the Ontario Tobacco Survey study. So here I'm just briefly talking about the sample for the analysis in this study. We included smokers at baseline, and those smokers were seen by our health practitioners, including physician, dentist, pharmacist, or nurse, at least once during the six follow-up interviews. The sample size was roughly 3,500 smokers. The brief advice was derived from participants' response to the survey question at each follow-up. We asked them, in the past 6 months, have you seen a doctor, dentist, pharmacist, or nurse? And if the smokers answered yes, we asked them, did the doctor, dentist, pharmacist, or nurse advise you to reduce or quit smoking? If the answer is yes, then this was defined as a brief advice they received. The cessation medications include any use of the following medication during the follow-up, including nicotine replacement therapy, any form of nicotine gum, patches, lozenges, tablets, or spray or inhaler. And another type is the bupropion, Zyban, or Wellbutrin, and also the medication of Champix or someone called Varenicline. In this study, we used two quitting outcomes. One is making a quit attempt. The question for this is, in the past 6 months, did you try to quit smoking completely? If the answer is yes, then this is defined as having a quit attempt. And another quitting outcome is the short-term quitting. If smoker, you know, continues to quit for at least 1 month during follow-up. Then we conducted a mediation analysis. To conduct this type of analysis, we need to run a few models. The first one is to look at the direct impact from advice. Here we use X to indicate the independent variable, and if advice influence the quitting outcomes. And then from this model, we can get a coefficient we call C here for the direct impact from advice to quitting outcomes. And then we run another model to look at association between advice from health professionals to medication use. And the parameter here we call A. That's for the association between brief advice to medication use. And then we run another model to look at the indirect impact from brief advice to quitting outcomes. Well, we included the medication use in the same model. And from this model, we can get two parameters. One is C prime, we call. That's the coefficient for the association from advice to quitting outcomes. And then we also got another coefficient that we call B. That's for the association between medication use to the quitting outcome. Based on these four parameters, we can estimate mediation effect size. Briefly here is the product A and B divided by the product A and B plus the coefficient C prime. And then we use the Sobel test to determine if the mediation effect is significant or not. Here are some results. This slide shows advice by health professionals. During follow-up, the majority of the smoking patients were seen by a physician, about 80%. Another 20% were seen by other health professionals, such as pharmacists, dentists, or nurses, but not a physician. Among those health professionals, the provision of advice was highest among physicians, about 55%, followed by dentists and nurses, roughly at 38% and 33% respectively, and the lowest among pharmacists, only 14%. And altogether, the provision of advice was about 57%. So more than 40% of patients, when they were seen by health professionals, didn't receive any advice. Among those, this slide shows the use of medication by advice. Among those who received advice, 23% of smokers used cessation medications. Among smokers who didn't receive advice, only 13% used the medication. So the rate of use of cessation medication was almost double among those who received advice than those who didn't receive advice. And this slide shows who received advice. Some characteristics compared to smoking patients who didn't receive any advice, smokers who received advice were older and less educated. They were more likely to be daily smokers, smoke more cigarettes per day, and they were self-rated more likely to be tobacco dependent. And they are less likely to have home smoking restrictions, and they made more lifetime quit attempts in the past compared to smokers who didn't receive advice. So in summary, smokers who received advice were more likely to be those who are more tobacco dependent, and it was more difficult for those smokers to quit smoking in general. And this slide shows the advice medication use and the quitting. There was a clear dose-response relationship between the number of advice received from different types of health professionals. And then with the quit attempts, from 17% for those who didn't receive any advice to 31% who received all four types of health professional advice. And then if they received one type, two types, it's just in between. But there was no clear dose-response relationship between number of advice received and short-term quitting. But for the association between number of advice received and the medication use, there was a clear dose-response relationship. More number of advice received, more likely to use cessation medication. This slide shows the quitting outcome of making a quit attempt. Among smokers who received advice and used the cessation medication, the rate of making a quit attempt was highest at 59%. But if they received advice but didn't use cessation medication, the rate of making a quit attempt was much lower at 13%. Together, altogether, among smokers who received the advice, the rate of making a quit attempt was about 24%. Among smokers who didn't receive advice to quit smoking, but if they used cessation medication, the rate of making a quit attempt was higher at 52%. Among the groups that didn't receive advice to quit smoking and they didn't use cessation medication, the rate was lower at 12%. And altogether, among smokers who didn't receive advice, the rate of making a quit attempt was at 17%. And this slide shows the quitting outcomes of short-term quitting. Among those who received advice and used cessation medication, the rate of short-term quitting was high at 13%. And the rate of short-term quitting among those who received advice but didn't use cessation medication was low at 4%. Among all groups of smokers who received advice, the rate of short-term quitting was 6%. Among the group who received who didn't receive the advice but used the medication, the short-term quitting was high at 19%. Among the group of smokers who didn't receive advice and didn't use cessation medication, the rate of short-term quitting was low at 6%. And altogether, among this group who didn't receive the advice, the rate of short-term quitting was 8%. And this slide shows the mediation analysis results for the quitting outcome of making a quit attempt. So for the first model, we look at the direct impact from advice to making a quit attempt. We found the coefficient for C, I think it makes sense, is odds ratio here. It's 1.41, and the p-value was less than 0.01. So that means the advice, receiving advice from health professionals increased making a quit attempt about, in terms of odds ratio, 41% higher than those who didn't receive any advice. And then for the next model, we see smokers who received advice were more likely to use medication. The odds ratio was 1.72, and the p-value was less than 0.01. And then from advice, receiving advice also increased the making a quit attempt while the model included medication use. So the indirect impact from advice to making a quit attempt was significant. Although the odds ratio was kind of low at 1.18, but p-value was significant, less than 0.01. And then another model we look at the medication use to making a quit attempt was significant. The odds ratio was really high at 8.53, and the p-value was significant, less than 0.01. That means if you use medication for cessation, those smokers would be more likely to making a quit attempt. And we use all the four parameters here, get the mediation effect size at 79%. That means the effect of advice on making a quit attempt was significant, and the majority of the effect was due to use cessation medication at 79%. And this mediation effect of medication use on the association between advice and making a quit attempt was large and significant. And this slide shows the outcome of short-term quitting. The direct impact from advice to short-term quitting was not significant. the odds ratio was 1.03 and p-value greater than 0.05. But similar to the previous slide, from the advice to medication use was significant. Odds ratio is the same at 1.7. The indirect impact from advice to short-term creatine was not significant either. The C prime, the odds ratio was only 0.89, the p-value was greater than 0.05. But again, from medication use to short-term creatine was significant. The odds ratio was 3.88 and p-value less than 0.01. So based on these four parameters, we estimated that the mediation effect size was 77%. This means the impact from advice to short-term creatine was significant, and the majority of the impact was due to use cessation medication at 77%. So in conclusion, health professionals should provide advice to their smoking patients and they encourage their patients to use cessation medication when smokers find it's difficult to quit without support. And that's my presentation. Thank you.
Thanks so much, both. We're going to take some questions now from the audience. It looks like we've got one already from Anik Labelle. So Anik is saying, the slide on advice by health professionals, do the percentages show the number of patients who received advice of the number or the number of health professionals who gave it?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, we don't know the number of advice during the 6 months. We only know the number of health professionals. So
no, I think she's meaning it the other way around. So we didn't ask the health professionals. But we asked the people, and so they reported whether or not they received advice. So,
but not how many numbers of advice they received.
No, so
from different types of health professionals.
Maybe just one very busy health professional giving lots of advice, or it may be evenly spread about the population. We don't know. All that we know is that the people who do visit the doctor or other health professionals, which is most people, the roughly 60% of them will receive advice from somebody.
Right.
Okay. We're going to give another couple minutes to see if there are any more questions from the audience. So type away into the chat box.
So, I mean, to comment,
yeah, sure.
I think that your presentation is really exciting. It from a population perspective, what it's saying is that that the people who are receiving advice from are actually less likely to quit successfully than the people who aren't. We shouldn't be too scared by this for a couple of reasons. One is that with the people who are receiving advice are those who are going to have more difficulty quitting.
That's right.
So in our RCTs and the randomized control trials that have been done before, health professional advice is effective at increasing the rates. But what's happening is that the people who are getting the advice are the ones who aren't doing very well. And so from a population perspective, from our perspective of trying to reduce the prevalence of smoking in the population, asking just these people is good for those people, help them quit smoking relative to what they would have done otherwise. But we're not going to see a dramatic change in the overall rates of smoking because these are we're not getting the low-hanging fruit. And so this paper really says there are two ways to really help change the rates of smoking through health professional advice. One is to start asking people who are, or start giving advice to people who aren't going to have such difficulty quitting, to provide help to people who are going to have a little bit easier time in actually becoming smoke-free, and that will help change prevalence. And the second bit is through this mediation pathway, that health, particularly within this group of people who are quitting smoking, cessation medication is really effective at helping people quit. And making sure that that pathway is activated for the people who need help, that they get help. And that's it's a really important part of this mechanism and the way that we're seeing health professional advice be effective at all in this population is through actually giving them something to help them rather than the advice on its own. Being told by a doctor or dentist doesn't actually make you better at quitting smoking. They need something else to help that process along.
And we have another question here from Helen Tunney. Further to a next question, how many people did you ask versus percentages?
Well, we asked them during each 6 months. So all the smokers included in this study, about 3,500, we asked this question. So it's based on any 6 months and average it. So it's hard to say because we clamped, summarized that together during 6 follow-ups. So it's kind of present time. So one maybe contribute a few more, others may contribute 0. So I don't have the exact number over here because some people may receive, first 6 months, next 6 months, and then 6 times maybe. But we average them over 6 interview times.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is that there are 3,600 people in our survey. It was a population representative survey, so it is it's representative of the smoking population of Ontario. And generally the nearly everyone saw a doctor and those percentages are over this 3-year period of time in which we followed people, that's what we'd expect to see.
So we have another question from Karen Taylor. Could it be that those not receiving advice have intrinsic motivation for quitting versus those receiving advice being motivated to please their healthcare provider?
I think so, yeah, because from our study, at least, brief advice alone, it doesn't make people quit for at least 1 month, but it may encourage them to make a quit attempt. So if you give some free medications, it will help them, quit longer. But on the other hand, other studies have shown that at population level, the more important stuff is to, encourage people to make quit attempts. The more quitting attempt means the more successful. If there's no quitting attempt, you never get a successful quitting. So both are important.
And it's certainly true that the population who are receiving advice are those who are going to have challenges in quitting, whether or not they appear to want to quit more and that they have tried to quit more, but they do have more challenges in doing it. And I think that's an important insight of your work.
Right. And Susan Himmel asks, says thanks to the both of you, and then asks the following question. Would you say that this study suggests that workplace cessation programs that include brief advice and free medication, or NRT, would have a strong potential to affect population cessation rates?
I think we just answered that question.
It depends. And I think is the answer. It's like it depends if the advice is only going to people who are going to have difficulty quitting, it will help those people, but it won't do much about our population rates. I think it's important to help people, so our focus shouldn't necessarily be only on changing prevalence. But will that program bring down our smoking rates in Ontario? And the answer is it would be challenging, or that we'd have to really have huge numbers of people enrolled to make a difference. But certainly within the context of a smoking cessation program, it does seem important to provide some sort of assistance to make that program effective.
And there's somebody typing another question right now, so we'll wait for them. Thanks so much, everyone, for asking your questions today. And Nancy Bradshaw asks, do you have any practical take-home messages for public health units that are providing direct cessation services in clinics?
Well, I think you should definitely encourage people to make a quit attempt, no matter if it's successful or not. And then if you know some smokers may have difficulty to quit, definitely encourage them to use cessation medications. And on the side note, because I have another study about the nicotine replacement therapy duration and smoking cessation at the population level. So you needed to make sure, you know, your patient or smokers should take enough and, you know, long enough the nicotine replacement therapy or other cessation medications. The other study shows that if you take less than 4 weeks of an RT, it doesn't help smokers to quit. So you have to, you know, follow the recommendation duration that's about 8 to 12 weeks.
And just to add on your point about increasing quit attempts, there's I think you're referring to a study as well that out of California, there was an RCT, and it looked at, it had three groups. It had a group where they gave nicotine replacement therapy, they mailed it to them. They had a group where they gave them a voucher so they could get nicotine replacement therapy from a pharmacy. And then there was a group where they mailed placebo patches to people. So they were just, they had no medication in them. They're just pure placebos. And what ended up happening is the group who had the placebo patches did better than the ones who had to go to the pharmacy to get their patches. And that was because that they, despite it not helping them, it was better at increasing the quit attempts. So the overall, the absolute numbers of people who were able to quit, it was more important to make sure that they were made that quit attempt rather than the effectiveness of that quit attempt. What we're saying here is that given within a clinical situation in particular, that effectiveness is often driven by, is there something within that program that makes that person, would help that person? That's a slightly different question, but an important one too.
We have a follow-up question just to your reference to the placebo study. Jeff Connors is just wondering what study that was referencing. Do you know?
It's Shuhong Zhu, I don't remember where it was. Was it published?
I don't know. I haven't found this one. I'm not quite sure if it's published or just in press.
I think it may be published. So Shuhong Zhu is a researcher out of California. I think it uses Quitline in California.
Maybe we can search. If we found it, we can send it to this
person. Yeah, definitely. We can forward it to the group. We've got a link in the chat box from Lynn Ward linking to Dr. Zhu's presentation from the PTCC Knowledge Exchange Forum. So that resource, Jeff, is online. Perfect. Lynn, thank you so much. And we have a question from Marie Chavez. Did you look at people who suffer from mental health issues? Yeah, we can go back to that. We'll just go with Marie for now. Okay. Did you look at people who suffer from mental health issues with respect to heaviness of addiction and inability to succeed at quitting? Did this drive up the number of unsuccessful quit attempts?
It could be because, you know, when you look at the quitting successful rate or something, you have to consider so many factors, and one of the factors would be the mental health issue, and the others would be, and those people normally are more tobacco dependent, so they have the difficulty to quit, and for those people normally they should use the cessation medication and maybe intensive behavioral support.
Yeah, we didn't measure it specifically in the survey, but it's very likely that that the people who received advice had additional comorbidities of various sorts, both physical and likely mental.
Yeah, and ChemEdge has a clinic to treat those people with mental health issues. If you need help, you can contact Dr. Peter Selby, who's in charge of this.
Great, and we have a previous question. We have a previous question from So a previous question from Lori asking about what are your thoughts in an acute setting, just providing NRT, e.g. in a hospital setting, without any advice. Do you think you'd expect similar findings where smokers would be able to quit without advice from a healthcare professional?
I would say that, you know, giving even very brief advice is better than just, you know, deliver the free NRT per se without advice. And, you know, brief advice can be just something like asking if your patient is a smoker or not, and, you know, how much cigarettes per day you smoke, very briefly. And then you say, well, you need to quit, or at least you need to reduce your current smoking levels. That may just run maybe 20 or 30 seconds. It doesn't, you know, cost us so much time to do. I believe, you know, with the brief advice and cessation medication would result in the best results for quitting successful.
Yeah, to go on to the follow-up question about differentiating brief advice to intensive, I don't have the studies on top of mind, but certainly that even very brief advice, as Bo said, is telling people to quit, essentially, or you should quit, it has been shown to be effective. And I think there is a dose-response relationship. The more advice is better, but I think it is not it's not exponentially better. But I think there is some indication that more does help.
Based on a recent Cochrane review by Dr. Stad, the brief advice normally runs from 30 seconds to 3 minutes. And then for the intensive advice, on average, it runs about 10 minutes. That's kind of definition, but there are so many different definitions, so it depends on how many sessions of cessation you give, and what type of behavioral support you have. So intensive kind of advice may, you know, vary quite largely. But brief advice is normally, you know, less than 3 minutes advice.
Okay, so, and that, just adding that question was from Al, and Al says thanks for answering his question. Maria Shear says, thanks so much for an insightful presentation, so important for cardiac rehab and cardiac research settings. And we have a question via email now from Brenda. Were any variables included which track whether additional supports such as one-on-one counseling, group supports, and or smokers' helpline would increase quit attempts or short-term quit attempts?
Well, in my study, I controlled for intensive kinds of behavioral therapy, including the helpline and, you know, if the smoker attended the quitting program. But we don't have the detailed information for in like one-to-one kind of counseling, that kind of program. We may, I don't know, I kind of...
There was a question about specialized counseling, right. but that was the rates of that use are very low in
yes.
the population.
Right. If the number is too small, we may not be able to do. But in my analysis, I controlled for these variables.
Okay, we've got another question from Cheryl. Do you feel physicians need more education in tobacco to feel comfortable asking about tobacco? And are they really prepared to address medications?
I think based on few studies in the UK and Australia, I haven't seen a study in Canada. Anyhow, I think the general sense is that physicians are more comfortable than other health professionals to give advice, but even among physicians, they think they need more training. So, you know, I think we need more resources and training programs for those health professionals. And I know in the UK they have like a module for training physicians to do cessation advice. It's a very brief advice, lasts for 30 seconds, so and it's available online. So if you're interested, you can find this program online.
Great. I just thank everybody for their questions, but I want to make sure that we stay on time as well. So I'm going to thank everybody for participating, and thanks for actively asking so many questions. That's wonderful to have such a thoughtful audience. And thanks again to Dr. Zhang and Dr. Chaitin for joining us today. We really appreciated you both coming and presenting on your work. That was great. And a link to our webinar survey is going to be mailed to you following this webinar. Please fill it out. Let us know how we did today. Your feedback is really important to us going forward and making more webinars and ensuring we're relevant to your work. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye.
Ha ha ha.